Welcome to Securing America with me, Frank Gaffney, the program that's a kind of owner's manual for protecting the country we love against all enemies, foreign and domestic, to the glory of God and his kingdom. In the effort to protect our country against enemies, foreign particularly, we have to be alert to the prospect that they are actually not just overseas, but they're operating in our own country as well. We've done some fantastically interesting webinars of our Committee on the Present Danger China in the past week about enablers of those kinds of operations with respect to the Chinese Communist Party. Elite Capture is the title of one. One of the experts who contributed to that particular webinar, which you can get, by the way, at presentdangerchina.org, is our first guest, a regular here, I'm pleased to say, usually about this time. We're always pleased to have him with us. His name is Charles Sam Faddis. He has, well, extensive experience in a lot of relevant areas and in the service of our country, notably as an army officer and as an undercover operative of the Central Intelligence Agency. He's an author, among other things, of Beyond Repair, The Decline and Fall of the CIA, and the driving force behind a terrific online resource, andmagazine.com. You can follow it at Substack these days. Sam Faddis, it's good to have you with us always. Welcome back, sir.
Thank you for having me, Frank, as always.
Well, thank you for that really important contribution that you made to, I thought, one of our best webinars. We also did one more recently this week featuring Joe Biden and Hunter Biden and the laptop from hell, as it's been called, and specifically the enabling of the Chinese Communist Party, that the compromise of our chief executive represents. We're now looking, I think, at a very distinct problem that they are apparently enabling. And I just wanted to bounce it off of you, Sam, as a guy who's got extensive experience in undercover operations. The Chinese Communist Party reportedly has now opened up so-called police service centers around the world. By one estimate, at least 54 of them, including apparently some here. And their purpose, we're told, is to help enforce a law that the Chinese Communist Party enacted in September, whereby they can reach out extraterritorially, as it's called, to other countries, both to touch, if you will, their own nationals and apparently foreigners who have violated some law or other in the Chinese Communist realm. Should we be concerned, Sam, about such an enterprise, especially in our own country, but frankly, anywhere elsewhere in the world?
You know, one of the things that fascinates me about Marxist, Frank, is the capacity to use language in such an interesting way, isn't it? Police service centers. I'm surprised the word benevolent was not working in there at some point.
I'm sure that's in the Chinese original.
I'm sure in the Chinese it says that, yes. Yeah. Yes, we should be concerned. I mean, you know, you and I are talking about this all the time. There's this massive effort on the part of the media and so many interests to portray the Chinese Communist Party as this wonderful, touchy-feely, civilized institution, when it's basically a transnational criminal organization and this big thuggish organism. And I say this all the time, talking just about espionage. If you're a Chinese national, you do what the CCP tells you to do, and you are completely subject to their authority, not because you necessarily want to. In fact, you may despise them and want nothing more than to get out from under their thumb, but you lack that capacity. If you ever want to touch Chinese soil again, if you have any friends or any relatives anywhere in China, which certainly most folks do, then you will do whatever they tell you to do. And that includes getting on a plane and going back to Beijing to be prosecuted because you dared to open your mouth or disobey an order. And honestly, this is par for the course for thuggish regimes all around the world. If you're an Iraqi, when Saddam was in power and you were an Iraqi national, and Saddam came and said, do X, Y, and Z, you did not thumb your nose at the man and say, I will walk as a free man on the earth. You did whatever he told you to do, including blowing people up, shooting people, doing whatever. So yeah, there. And what is this administration going to do? You made reference to Hunter's laptop. An administration bought and paid for by Beijing will stand in the way of this? Absolutely not.
Yeah. What's particularly troubling about this, and it's a report out of Spain by a group called Safeguard Defenders, entitled 110 Overseas, a reference apparently to the 911 equivalent number in China, 110. Chinese transnational policing gone wild. And I dwell on it because one of the things that we've seen done with the Chinese Communist Party's police is in the Solomon Islands. They have begun effectively opening now a new, well, colony in some parts of those islands that we fought and bled to liberate from an imperial operation not so long ago. And now it's being essentially colonized, it seems, by the Chinese Communist Party, using sort of police as the leading edge. What that will mean in other parts of the world in terms of at least, you know, more aggressive, coercive intelligence and influence operations, of course, remains to be seen. But I couldn't agree with you more. This is a bad business, and it shouldn't be happening in our country, at the very least, and arguably not in Canada, not in other parts of the West, certainly as well. Sam, let me pivot a little bit. One of the other things that has been developing, and I wanted to get your thoughts about it, in connection with China's no limits partner, is the Russian aggression against Ukraine. I'd like to talk to you about that probably after a short break, but before we do, just a quick question. Somebody blew up, apparently, sabotaged, we're told, not one, not two, but three strands of pipelines that the Russians had laid to bring natural gas to Europe, the so-called Nord Stream 1 and 2 pipelines. What's your thought on who was responsible for that and the implications of it?
Well, I mean, let's just start with this. There are apparently very large explosive charges in placed on pipelines at least three locations, maybe now four locations, down about 200 feet in the Baltic. And whoever did that got in, did all of this, which is a massive technical and logistical accomplishment, and got out undetected, right? So you could just start with the fact that there's no terrorist group operating on the face of the earth with the capacity to go do that. And there are only a handful of state actors with the capacity to do that. So we're down to the United States, the Russians, I guess the Chinese, although I have no idea why they would want to do that. You know, that far from home, you're not talking about the Israelis, you're not talking about anybody else. I mean, we're down to about three people, three national entities. And at the top of that list, it either is the United States sabotaging those pipelines, for whatever, based on whatever calculus, or the Russians decided to effectively blow up, I'm not sure
their own assets,
the Russians, but blow up their own pipelines.
Yeah. Sam, we have to take a short break. As I said, I want to come back to you shortly and ask about why any of us would want to do this, but we'll reserve on that. And also the question more broadly of where are we with respect to the annexation of territory and the implications of all of that for Ukraine and the rest of us. We'll talk with Sam Faddis about that right after this. This is Frank Affney with the Secure Freedom Minute. At a summit this week in Washington, leaders of most Pacific Island nations agreed to paper over differences with the Biden administration that have given the Chinese Communist Party strategically ominous openings for its regional influence operations and colonization. The Solomon Islands Prime Minister, however, did not sign on to the summiteer's joint declaration. More importantly, he has allowed so-called police from China to be stationed in his country. Beijing is exploiting this opening to operate in and ultimately militarize islands like Guadalcanal that Americans bled and died to liberate from an earlier totalitarian empire. It turns out the Chinese police are reportedly setting up secretive service centers elsewhere around the world, including in Canada and even here. Are we okay with the CCP thus implementing a new law authorizing extraterritorial enforcement of its policies against Chinese nationals and foreigners? This is Frank Affney. Back. Charles Sam Faddis is in the house virtually. He is a retired Central Intelligence Agency clandestine service operator, a man we turn to with regularity for his insights into some of the things that are happening around the world that, well, require some scrutiny, but also some really, I think, clear-eyed analysis and experience. And he brings all that to bear at andmagazine.com. Sam, we were talking before the break a little bit about the seeming destruction, at least interruption for some period of time, of these pipelines. The Europeans had been very reluctant to stop taking Russian gas. The Russians had withheld most of it, but this now would ensure that they will not be providing it anytime soon. The question is, who would have had a motive to do something like this? It is noteworthy that the event, whatever it was, sabotage presumably, took place concurrently with a new pipeline from Norway to Poland opening up. How does that enter into the calculation of who might be responsible?
Well, look, if you look at this in the straightforward way that I think you and I and most Americans would analyze the situation, I think whether you want to conclude that or not, the most likely culprit is the United States, that we decided to take this Russian pipeline, these two Russian pipelines, completely out of the calculus, particularly against the backdrop of this brand new pipeline.
And President Biden and I think an undersecretary now at the State Department, yes, Victoria Nuland, both made explicit threats to that effect.
They both said very clearly some time ago that these pipelines would go away in effect if Russia invaded Ukraine. So I think, you know, now there's some real policy questions about whether that was a smart thing to do or not, because it represents, at a minimum, an escalation before we get to all the other aspects. And now the question would be, if that's what just happened, what is Vladimir Putin planning on doing in response to that? Because he's not going to sit there quietly. And do we want, from a geopolitical strategic standpoint, to really be spinning this thing up into an ever greater conflict? I think, you know, sober minds would, I think, really disagree. Could you construct a reason that the Russians did it? Yeah, sure, because in my experience, and I'm sure in yours, the Russians have done all kinds of things over the years that leave you scratching your head at the convoluted thought process that was involved. And at the end of the day, you're like, wow, okay, you think in a very different way than I do, buddy. Blowing up your own pipeline made sense to you. So I don't think that should be regarded as science fiction or conspiracy theory. Okay. Definitely possible.
This spinning up, as you put it, Sam, takes on a whole new level of concern with the annexation today by Vladimir Putin of parts of Ukraine that his troops have either conquered or had access to, at least in the past, and are presumably intent on recovering. With the backdrop being that these will now henceforth be Russian territory, and any attack upon them will be attack upon the motherland itself and responded to accordingly. He seems to say, well, with regularity, including perhaps with nuclear weapons. Your thoughts?
Well, look, let me preface this just very briefly by saying Vladimir Putin's a thug. He's a relic of the old Soviet Union. And it's very clear that his objective is to reconstitute as much of the old Soviet Union as he can and at every opportunity. Okay, so I have zero sympathy for Vladimir Putin. Do not endorse his motives. That said, it is not in our best interest to perpetuate this conflict, you know, to turn this into a perpetual war. The Russians are not our main enemy. The Chinese dwarf them in all significance. And you got nuclear weapons at the heart of this. And basically, our national strategic objective should be bring this thing to a conclusion before it spins out of control, because it's not helpful to us from our national security perspective. The Ukrainians lost those areas along the border effectively a long time ago. They're never going to get them back. And they're never going to get Crimea back. I mean, at least in the foreseeable future. And the people that think they want to topple Vladimir Putin, I mean, if he vanished off the face of the earth and a stable government replaced him tomorrow, I'd be the first guy to cheer. But we all know that's not how this works. You topple Vladimir Putin, you have no idea what replaces him, nor where those thousands of nuclear weapons go. So Vladimir's losing the war, and I think we ought to be doing everything possible to bring this to negotiation and conclusion. He has lost big time. Ukraine is going to continue moving toward the West, and all pretense that he has the capacity to reestablish the Soviet Union has been exposed as just that, pretense. So he's lost massively. Every former Soviet republic around them has seen that the Red Army doesn't exist. The Red Army that rolled into Berlin is gone. So this is a catastrophic defeat for the Russians. Let's just bring it to a close before God knows, you know, he actually uses a nuclear weapon on Ukraine.
Do you consider that to be a distinct possibility at this point, Sam?
Vlad is a lot of things. He's not crazy. He's not a madman. Do I believe he's got his finger on the trigger getting ready to do this imminently? I do not. But the extent of the military defeat he is suffering here, I think most people still don't want to face. And the more you push him into a corner, and the more you, if he even begins to feel like you're actually threatening his own, you know, position as president, I think you turn that into a real possibility. I mean, I think we create the conditions for that. So let's just, you know, look, the Ukrainians need to understand we're going to support you so far. Clearly, we have stood behind you. We will stand behind you. But we got to get to a negotiating table and sign an agreement and bring this thing to a close before all the whole world is paying a price for it.
Yeah. I guess the concern that some have is that, you know, this will effectively be rewarding Putin for what he has done and to give him, yes, a face-saving out, but in the process, perhaps simply set the stage for his next acts of aggression. But I very much take your point that we are really at risk of having our eye off the main danger that we are confronting, yes, which is not him, but his senior partner in that No Limits partnership, the Chinese Communist Party. Speaking of which, Sam, one of the travesties, of course, of this administration was the surrender in the most, you know, appalling fashion of not just Afghanistan writ large to another set of allies of the Chinese Communist Party, or at least vassals of it emerging as such, the Taliban, but specifically a base that the Chinese apparently are very keen on having access to. replete with, we're told, some $85 billion worth of armaments. Some of the best stuff in our arsenal, in fact. You've recently reported at End Magazine that they are refurbishing that base, and we've got less than a minute. Give us a quick assessment of why.
There's the $60,000 question, right? You have a giant air base that is capable of handling the largest military aircraft on the planet. You got a bunch of guys who don't have an air force outside of maybe a couple of helicopters that they crash every once in a while, who are now showing an intense interest on putting that air base back into operation. And as we've reported it in before, we know the Chinese are on the ground at Bagram. So, you know, if I'm looking for the number one suspect of who's going to operate out of Bagram Air Base, it's clearly going to be the Chinese Air Force, not the Taliban.
And that's not good for us, among others. Sam Faddis, we have to leave it at that. We'll be back with more on that subject, among others, with you next week. And thank you for your time today, my friend. Godspeed in all you do at End Magazine and elsewhere. We'll be right back with more here at Securing America right after this.
And throw Molotov cocktails in an effort to destroy police stations, federal courthouses, and local businesses, all in the name of anti-fascism. Most Americans are now, sadly, all too aware of the movement known as Antifa. But where did they come from? What do they want? And how do we stop their campaign of violent mayhem? The Center for Security Policy Press is proud to present Unmasking Antifa, Five Perspectives on a Growing Threat. This new book looks at the history, ideology, organization, finances, and strategy of Antifa, and provides an in-depth analysis for law enforcement officers, policymakers, and the general public. From street fighting tactics of the Black Bloc to fundraising by prominent left-wing foundations, Unmasking Antifa is the go-to guide to understand this elusive and dangerous threat. Get your copy of Unmasking Antifa, Five Perspectives on a Growing Threat at Amazon.com.
Welcome back, and I'm very pleased to say we've been able to catch up with Cleo Pascal, a woman we spoke to a couple of days ago about what was then an upcoming event in Washington, D.C., now one that she participated in a bit of and has insights about now in the rearview mirror. It was a U.S. Pacific Island Country Summit that took place in Washington, D.C., as it turns out, it involved some Pacific Island countries and some that weren't exactly, and some that our countries were not included. And it's an interesting question about how this all came together. But more to the point, what we're really interested in is whether something useful has come of it. I did a commentary today in which I understood the Solomon Islands didn't participate, or didn't at least participate in the sense of agreeing to the declaration that came out of it, but corrected on that by Cleo, and we'll talk a bit more about that. But Cleo, first, welcome. It's great to have you with us. You are, of course, a non-resident fellow of the Foundation for Defense of Democracy, one of our leading experts in the West on this region of the world. And so I'm delighted, as always, to have a chance to visit with you a bit about what happened there. Thanks for joining us once again to give us a post-mortem, as they say.
A great pleasure. And again, thank you for covering the topic. It's an important one, I feel. Yeah,
it is. Tony Blinken said, you know, our security and the security of the world depends on the security of these nations. So, you know, let's explore that proposition. First, I guess I'd ask you your impressions of the event and whether you think it advanced the security interests of the world, ours as well as the islands in question.
Several documents came out of it. The U.S. Released its first Pacific Island strategy. There was a joint declaration. There was fact sheets. There were press conferences. There's a lot to disaggregate, to take a look and see, first of all, what they were actually trying to accomplish, and then whether that was accomplished, and then what that will mean going forward. As it now stands, from the point of view of at least getting people in the room, that's always a good thing. In terms of what's been recommended, there's been a lot thrown at the wall. And a lot that's been presented as new money or new announcements, which are not new. And the Pacific Island leaders are very smart, so they know that. So what they come away with is they know there's some U.S. interest. The U.S. interest, based on some of the declarations, seems to be very heavily filtered through an Australian and New Zealand lens. So one of the declarations was, for example, that the U.S. would now recognize the Cook Islands and Niue as countries. The Cook Islands and Niue are part of the realm of New Zealand, and the people of those places carry New Zealand citizenship. So essentially what the U.S. has done is said, we're going to encourage New Zealand to have 3 votes in international fora. So that sort of thing gives that little kind of detail like that gives an indication of who has been driving a lot of this. I was also privileged to be at a Chamber of Commerce breakfast, which had the leaders in attendance. And the Chamber of Commerce started the event by thanking the representative from New Zealand for his help in setting things up. So those sort of things make you wonder how independent the policy is, because the core U.S. Interest in the region really should be the freely associated states, the U.S. freely associated states, Palau, Micronesia, Federated States of Micronesia, and RMI, Republic of the Marshall Islands. And I spoke to President Whips about this, president of Palau, and he pointed out that on his way to the U.S. meeting, he had been in Japan, where he had a 2-hour one-on-one meeting with Prime Minister Kishida of Japan. And you can compare that to being lumped into a room with 13 other Pacific Island nations in the context of this meeting. So there's, I think, some reprioritization that should be done. In parallel with this larger outreach to the entire region.
New Zealand as a interlocutor or driving force would seem problematic in a number of respects. They've not been all that helpful, as I understand it, on sort of the China front. And to the extent that their government is, you know, pretty hard to the left, it would be, I would think, not a particularly promising partner in this endeavor to really anchor these various nations in the United States or pro-Western, at least, orbit.
Frank, you probably remember the Buchanan incident. This isn't a new issue with New Zealand being perhaps not the most in line with U.S. interests partner on the planet. But the other kind of more fundamental.
That's a reference to the banning nuclear warships or nuclear capable warships that we wouldn't disclose had nuclear weapons on them or not, right?
Yeah, that's right. I mean, they're happy to be protected by the U.S. nuclear umbrella, but they just don't want to be seen to be, you know, and anyway.
They're one of the 5 eyes, as far as I can tell, but they seem to be winking a lot.
Yes. There's like a little something in the corner of their eye that they can't quite see clearly,
a,
I think.
A tick.
Yeah, that's right. But even more problematic from the point of view of the Pacific Islands is, they're going, why aren't you just dealing with us directly? Why are you going through this, what the Pacific Islands consider to be a colonial, post-colonial power in the region? You know, we're here, we're in the room, talk to us directly. We'll tell you. And in fact, at that breakfast, the Prime Minister of Papua New Guinea, you know, made some very strong points. And Papua New Guinea has a larger territory, physical territory, landmass, and a larger population than New Zealand, and it's more strategically located than New Zealand. You know, so why aren't we dealing with it as a proper country? Why would you use a proxy to deal with PNG? And currently, one of the other announcements was, for example, that the U.S. would be opening up new embassies, which is very important. It's a very good initiative in places like the Solomons. Currently, Solomons is being managed out of the U.S. embassy in PNG, but there's no resident ambassador in PNG at the moment. So let's start staffing up the diplomatic representation that's there now, and at the same time, do this other stuff.
We are also, of course, throwing money at the problem at the moment. Is this anything other than really kind of a bidding war with the Chinese, who are perfectly prepared, evidently, to put a lot more money into it as well?
So there's an announcement. You'll hear this announcement of $800 million in new money. These are not, the vast majority is not new, and most of it needs to be appropriated through Congress. Congress needs to approve it. So that also needs to be disaggregated. But again, one of the most important things that happened was this Chamber of Commerce meeting, because the countries in the Pacific, they don't want handouts. They want a chance to run their businesses and their economies in a normal fashion. And there's been breaks that have been put on their economies through things like restraints in transportation and expensive communications infrastructure, things like that. So what they're asking for example, just more direct flights. You know, let us do business with you. Bring your tourists, export our tuna, build up a call center, whatever it is. You know, just let us be a normal part of the global economy, because especially the Southern Pacific Islands are incredibly expensive to get to. Again, President Whips was saying, Palau is a 4-hour flight from Japan, but now they have to go through Guam and it costs $1,500 return. So you can't build up business linkages when you've got that kind of a, sort of 12-hour transit, and it's incredibly expensive. So that's what they want. They just want the business stuff. They don't want $20 million for, gender training. You know, they want... to be able to.
I shouldn't think we would either, for that matter, but obviously this administration does. Cleo, a question that I had for you is, much of this, for our purposes, presumably has an eye towards the Chinese threat to Taiwan, an island in the Pacific, the last time I checked. Taiwan was not present at this event. Was its security a subject of discussion, as far as you could tell?
So especially the U.S. Freely Associated States are very aware of this issue. And this comes into another question about the way that the U.S. is looking at the region through the organization that is in the document as saying is the core entry point for the U.S. into the region is the Pacific Island Forum. And there have been concerns about the relationship between the U.S. Freely Associated States and the Pacific Island Forum. Two of the three U.S. Freely Associated States, Palau and the Marshall Islands, recognize Taiwan. And there is a serious question about whether the Pacific Island Forum would allow a country that recognizes Taiwan to take a leadership position, because the influence of Australia and New Zealand in the forum might be being a proxy for pressure from other forces. So it plays into the Taiwan question, plays not only into the strategic component in the Northern Pacific, but into the political component in the larger Pacific. And that was especially the relationship between Taiwan and Taiwan recognizing countries in the Pacific Island Forum was not really addressed. The pressure for joining the forum, staying in the forum, making the forum central, that is again another priority that's coming out of Canberra and Wellington, which doesn't necessarily serve U.S. strategic interests.
We have to leave it at that, Cleo. There's obviously much more to tease out here, and I hope you'll come back to us for that purpose soon. I guess the bottom line is it seems as though it didn't do a lot of harm, but it may not have done as much good as we need to. I think it is encouraging that people want our embassies in these places and that the administration is finally stepping up to provide them such diplomatic ties. But it... it does seem as though we've got a long way to go. We'll be back with you for more. We'll be right back with the rest of you with more with Dr. Stephen Bryan about Taiwan and beyond right after this. This is Frank Affney with the Secure Freedom Minute. At a summit this week in Washington, leaders of most Pacific Island nations agreed to paper over differences with the Biden administration that have given the Chinese Communist Party strategically ominous openings for its regional influence operations and colonization. The Solomon Islands Prime Minister, however, did not sign on to the summiteer's joint declaration. More importantly, he has allowed so-called police from China to be stationed in his country. Beijing is exploiting this opening to operate in and ultimately militarize islands like Guadalcanal that Americans bled and died to liberate from an earlier totalitarian empire. It turns out the Chinese police are reportedly setting up secretive service centers elsewhere around the world, including in Canada and even here. Are we okay with the CCP thus implementing a new law authorizing extraterritorial enforcement of its policies against Chinese nationals and foreigners? This is Frank Affney. Welcome back, and a special pleasure to be able to welcome one of our senior fellows at the Center for Security Policy. His name is Dr. Stephen Bryan. He has a distinguished record of public service, notably as a Deputy Undersecretary of Defense when men were men back in the Reagan administration. I had the privilege of serving with him in his time there. He has gone on to be a very prominent figure in the defense industry, notably ran Finn Mechanica for a time, and these days
10 years, yeah, it was a long time.
Quite a time.
Yeah,
a lot of relevant experience as we talk about challenges that we're facing, foreign and domestic, and I'm always pleased to have him with us. Steve Bryan, once again, welcome back.
Thank you, Frank. Glad to be with you.
Thank you. Steve, you authored a book the other day, I guess a couple of months ago now, but it seems like just yesterday. It's certainly still very relevant about what the United States needs to be doing to deter the Chinese from invading Taiwan.
Right.
And there's a lot to talk about in this regard. The Chinese, of course, seem to be on rather better behavior, not great, but rather better behavior in the run-up to this.
Well, I mean, they're not running coronation. The blockade at the moment.
Yeah, there's the coronation that's in the offing, apparently, yeah, of Xi Jinping on the 16th of October. But
It's
widely expected that once that happens, if it does, all bets are off, and that he may well decide to move even more aggressively than he has of late.
Yeah.
What's your current reading on that situation?
No, I don't have a reading. I mean, I think it's really dangerous. I mean, look, every day they're still keeping up these flights around the island. They're still exercising their forces. They're just not blockading the island at the moment. Now, I think they're going to try and ratchet up more pressure on Taiwan. And at some point, you know, the problem here, anyone that understands the Chinese mind, or even anyone's mind in this case, has to understand that if China wants to really hit Taiwan, it's going to have to take out the U.S. assets in the region at the same time. And so we have very little choice in this. I mean, there's people in the United States that say, well, you know, it's the Taiwanese problem, not our problem. Unfortunately, it's our problem, too. It's Japan's problem, too. And Japanese understand absolutely right. But we're far from prepared. We're far from prepared. And we haven't done the basic things that we should be doing, like having a common command for the region, like having the right equipment pre-positioned. I mean, there's just all sorts of things that aren't being done that should be done. The administration seems to think it has, you know, plenty of time, can do what it wants. Chinese will behave themselves. They always have. That kind of nonsense. And that's not how you do strategy. And that's not how you do deterrence.
Big time. To the contrary, it seems as though you are effectively emboldening the Chinese by the lack of action. And this goes to the heart of a much larger problem, of course, which is the compromise of Joe Biden by the Chinese Communist Party. And I think they know that they can.
Well, there are a ton of American politicians that are compromised by the Chinese. It's not just Biden. It's very deep and very wide. But what that means is hard to say, because the Chinese don't trust the U.S. military. They're right not to trust the U.S. military. And they don't trust the Japanese at all. In fact, they dislike each other immensely, as you probably know. So it's a very volatile thing. And just kind of, let's worry about Ukraine. Let's not worry about Taiwan. Let's not worry about our strategic interests, our real strategic interests, because China is the big threat for the United States in the long run. Actually, even in the short run, it's a much bigger threat than Russia.
Indeed. Steve, assuming that the United States government, the United States commander-in-chief, the United States military are intent on preventing China from attacking Taiwan, one of the things that you recommended that seems to me to be a sort of corrective to a terrible mistake that is apparently now in the offing, namely the retirement of a large number of our frontline fighter aircraft, the F-22, best right. in the world, we believe. You've suggested that rather than send them to the boneyard, we ought to be sending them to Japan. I assume your preference would be, as is mine, that we keep them in the inventory.
Well, my real, real preference would be to keep them in the Air Force.
Right.
Because we need them. But if we're going to be deprived of them, putting them in the junk pile is not, first of all, from a monetary point of view, it's insane, because we've got a huge investment in these airplanes. Almost $500 million in every airplane, when you really put the R&D and everything else into the pot, and the years we've maintained them and the expenses of upgrading them, all these things. It's a lot of money to put in a desert. Why would you do that? Secondly, it's the one airplane that China is afraid of. I mean, they're really afraid of it, because it has the size of the radar signature of the F-22 is something like that. It's absolutely tiny. So their air defenses can't get it. Their fighter planes can't get it. It's a great air superiority airplane. In fact, it's the only air superiority airplane we got. And right now, by the way, we're not even deploying them to Japan. The ones we have, we're not even deploying to Asia, other than we've sent a few to Australia for a demonstration, but we're not deploying them. And it's craziness. I mean, one of the things we could
have... This all reinforces, it seems to me, Steve, the concern that this administration is not interested in deterring China.
No, they would say they don't want to provoke the Chinese, but the Chinese are provoking us. They're provoking us. I mean, how can you not... You have to meet them and say, hey, guys, you want to play this game? Look at our F-22 sitting there in on these Japanese airfields in Okinawa. Want to play with those?
Dispersed, because as you say, they are being...
You need to disperse them, because if you get them on the ground, they're no use.
Absolutely. Steve, we have to take a brief break. We'll be right back with more with Dr. Stephen Bryan, these days a senior fellow of our Center for Security Policy, and one of the clearest thinkers about national security in the United States today. We'll be right back with more right after this. Welcome back. We are speaking with Dr. Stephen Bryan, a man who has both some very important and extensive experience in the United States government, as well as in the defense industry, and who has been applying all of that experience, I think, admirably to a whole host of issues. And we've been talking with him about Taiwan and the mistake that we're making in the interest of not provoking the Chinese, probably enticing them to think that they can act with impunity against Taiwan. Steve, I wanted to pivot to another part of the world you've also been writing about, namely Ukraine. We talked earlier in the program with Sam Faddis a bit about this pipeline incident. And I'd like to get your thoughts on it as well. You've written about this at Asia Times. Give us a readout on who sabotaged this pipeline and why.
Well, that's a great question, Frank. I mean, because the only obvious why here, these were not operating pipelines. They were both shut down. One was shut down before it ever operated. That was Nord Stream 2. And the other one, the Russians shut down and because of the sanctions and the compressors for the pipe, Nord Stream 1, which weren't delivered and all this stuff. But the bottom line is that they were shut down and then somebody destroyed them. And they may have done a hell of a good job in destroying them. Whether they can even be repaired is an open question at the moment, or at least in the next years. You know, as a pipeline is open to the seawater, it destroys the insides of the pipes and it corrupts them and corrodes them too. So bottom line is that it's not sure that it can ever be turned back on. Who would want to do that? Well, the U.S. has said multiple times, the president said. Victoria Nuland, who's the Undersecretary of State, said, we're going to get rid of this Nord Stream 2, one way or the other. Well, what's that mean? It seems to me it means that either you're going to convince the Germans never to use it and to destroy whatever infrastructure is there so that they can't be turned back on, or you're going to destroy the pipeline so nobody can turn them back on. That's an implication of those statements. Doesn't mean they did it, not at all. But it means that they had the motive. And I worked on in the 1980s, and I think you remember this, Frank.
I was going to ask you about it next, as a matter of fact.
I mean, we tried to stop the pipelines from Russia going into Germany because we realized that that would make the Germans hostage to Russia, or to then the Soviet Union. And we did our best, and we lost that fight at the end. We had export controls and we tried to get the Norwegians to deliver more gas to Europe to try and solve the problem of their natural gas requirements, all this stuff. But, we were kind of laughed at by the Europeans. They didn't want anything to do with it.
As they did about Nord Stream as well.
They did it to Trump when he made his speech at the UN. I mean, endless.
But Steve, I think what's really critical about that earlier experience was President Reagan's efforts and not little help from yourself did slow it down. And I think that had the effect of denying them a source of revenue that was vitally needed to keep propping up the operation when the rest of the Reagan strategy was aimed at cutting off their cash flow. No,
that's right. Exactly right. Yeah. You remember that precisely. But what happened in 91 after the collapse of the Soviet Union, then the game book changed.
Right. Well, then we were helping the Russians. We were trying to
at least we were neutral, at least.
I think it was more than that. We were really trying to help prop up Yeltsin.
That's true. Yeah, you're absolutely right. No, that's absolutely right. So the bottom line is that the Germans then felt no obligation to do anything but finance, and they helped finance these Nord Stream operations to billions and billions of dollars.
Well, the former chancellor of Germany went to work on the Gazprom paper.
Well, he was on the board of directors. Yeah.
Yeah, indeed. So this raises the question of, if the United States did do this, and Sam has arrived at that conclusion as well, what is Putin's response?
Frank, I haven't arrived at the conclusion.
Well, he's leaning that way. I think it's fair to say he hasn't necessarily ruled out the Russians.
The motive was there to take away this asset because it was the one hammer that Putin had. If you make a deal with Ukraine and we solve the war and everybody's happy, we'll turn the gas back on, everything will be fine. Well, that option's gone now, off the table. Can't be done. Now, it's not inconsequential that we're delivering more and more LNG to Europe.
Yeah. And there's also a new pipeline from Norway to Poland.
Yeah, the one they told us they couldn't do 37 years ago. They said, you can't do it. It'll ruin our oil supply. You can't take the gas off the top because you'll ruin the oil underneath. Anyway, they're doing it. And, the new pipeline is just opened to Poland.
So where does this leave us if, in fact, Putin blames the United States for this act of war, I guess one might argue, and already is now positioning himself with this annexation of parts of Ukraine to claim that any effort to liberate those areas would be an attack on the motherland of Russia itself?
They signed the deal today in Moscow.
Yeah.
Look, both sides are positioning themselves for a conflict that won't end. And it will be very painful for everybody, not just the Ukrainians who are suffering a great deal because of this thing. But it's going to be very painful for the Europeans, and it could potentially involve U.S. forces actively. So this is a very dangerous situation. In 1985, Gorbachev, then the premier of the USSR, went to see François Mitterrand, then the president of France, and said, we're an undeveloped country with nuclear weapons. And everyone laughed, come on, tell us another story some other time. But that's kind of where we're at right now. And we have a situation where, the Russian military may say, if you want to solve this war, you got to use nuclear weapons. So it's a very, very dangerous thing, and we should be trying to reconcile it.
This is where Sam left us as well. We'll be back with both of you more next week. I hope to flesh out what that would look like. Thank you, Steve Bryan, always, for your leadership. And thanks to the rest of you for following us here at Securing America. Hope you do so again next time.